Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, July 13, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, where today we'll be discussing the Supreme Court's death penalty case, the Glossop case, and the death penalty cocktail. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to have with us today two experts, Mr. Kent Scheidegger. He's the Legal Director and General Counsel at the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation, and he'll be joined by Professor John Bessler, who's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. We're going to hear opening remarks from each, first from Mr. Scheidegger, but then, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions. So if you could have your questions ready when we get to that portion of the program, we'll be turning to you for those questions. With that, Mr. Scheidegger, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. Well, this decision that we just got from the Supreme Court, the story actually goes back a few decades. In the 70s and 80s, into the 90s, states turned to lethal injection as their method of execution to replace the earlier methods of the electric chair and the gas chamber, both in the belief that it was more humane and simply to end the litigation that was going on at that time about those other methods. The method used at that time was a three-drug method. The first drug used was a barbiturate, which was given in a massive dose that effectively would put the inmate into almost a coma. And then the second and third drugs would be injected, actually causing death. The third drug in particular would have been extremely painful if the person were not sedated. That did put an end to the litigation for a while, but then challenges were made to that protocol, which went to the Supreme Court in 2008 in a case called Bays versus Reese. And in that case, the claim was that if the first drug wasn't done right, that it would result in an unconstitutionally cruel execution. The Supreme Court rejected that claim in that case and upheld the protocol, but the controversy continued, and many states decided that they would get rid of the second and third drugs and simply use a massive dose of the barbiturate alone, which is in fact how animals are commonly euthanized in this country by veterinarians. The drug they were using at the time for the barbiturate was sodium thiopental, which was made by a company in the United States, but then that company moved its production to Italy, and the Italian government threatened it with license revocations and other sanctions if they allowed their drug to be used for executions. They simply got out of the business. Thiopental became very difficult for the states to obtain, and they switched to another drug called pentobarbital, which is the one veterinarians commonly use. That was made in the United States, but the company that made it was Danish, and it put restrictions on its distribution network, making that hard to obtain. So the consequence was that some of the states have gone to a third drug called midazolam, also called Versed, that's the trade name. That use is very controversial. There is conflicting scientific evidence in the case that went to the Supreme Court as to whether it was really sufficient to serve the function of an anesthetic to prevent pain as the second and third drugs are being injected. The Supreme Court decided, but it upheld the protocol in the particular case, but the controversy will continue. During oral argument, the Supreme Court some of the justices made statements to the effect that there was basically a guerrilla war going on against the death penalty, with people trying to cut off the supplies of the primary drugs being used for lethal injection, the preferred drugs, and whether the American judiciary should tolerate that and be effectively a party to it by disapproving the alternative drugs. The decision in the Glossop case requires that a person attacking a protocol on the basis that it creates an excessive risk of pain put forward a better alternative that is actually available to the state. That really puts a cramp in the method of attacking the death penalty of first cutting off the preferred drugs and then attacking the second choice drugs. I think the people engaging in that exercise have a real problem now. If all they succeed in doing is forcing the states to use drugs that are not as good and that have a greater risk of pain, it's highly questionable whether they've accomplished anything worthwhile. They may be actually hurting the very people they're trying to help. So I think I'll end at that point, and we'll hear from Professor Bessler, and then we'll go into the questions.
Great. Thanks, Kent, and thanks for participating, and thanks for the invitation to from the Federal Society to participate in this call. I thought I would begin. Justice Scalia's opinion at one point talks about the how Justice Breyer, who along with Justice Ginsburg, have raised real questions about the constitutionality of the death penalty sort of per se. Justice Scalia talks about in the opinion how Justice Breyer misunderstood the Enlightenment, which I wanted to begin there and talk about the history of the death penalty in the United States and the debate over the death penalty, since we're talking about the democratic process today as well. And Justice Scalia himself acknowledged in his own concurrence in Glossop that capital punishment presents moral questions that philosophers, theologians, and statesmen have grappled with for millennia. The founders of our Constitution, he writes, disagreed bitterly on the matter. I just finished writing a book called The Birth of American Law, where I look at the Italian Enlightenment's influence on the founders. And what I found in that research was that there was an Italian philosopher, again, Justice Scalia refers to philosophers, who was opposed to the death penalty, Cesare Beccaria. He was from Milan and wrote an influential treatise in 1764 in which he advocated for more proportionate penalties. He opposed the death penalty and torture. And that book was written in 1764, was translated into English in 1767. And in that, as a result of that book, it's clear from the evidence that Washington, Jefferson, Adams, series of the founders read that book and were influenced by it. In fact, in 1770, John Adams quoted Beccaria at the Boston Massacre trial. Jefferson copied more than two dozen passages from the book in the original Italian into his commonplace book and ended up drafting a bill for proportion in crimes and punishments, which actually cites Beccaria's work in a footnote. We also see that there are a number of the founders who were, if not completely opposed to the death penalty, then at least very ambivalent about its use. So Jefferson and Madison both advocated for restricting the death penalty. Dr. Benjamin Rush was a death penalty opponent, and he took that position before the Constitutional Convention. If we look at the going into the gloss of opinion, I'm probably not the, since as an opponent of the death penalty, I'm probably not the best person to debate how to implement it. And opponents of the death penalty obviously, you know, do not like the outcome in Glossop. So I think the best thing I can do is maybe provide a bit of a critique of the decision in Glossop and talk a little bit about the Supreme Court's existing eighth jurisprudence and one of the subjects of the debate today, which is executions generally and lethal injection protocol and the country's democratic institutions. First, I think that the decision is problematic, first, because it again approves the method of execution, allowing the use of the death penalty to continue, even though the death penalty is very rarely and sporadically inflicted at this point. There's been as Kent mentioned, there's been a real change over the years from one method of execution to the next. We went from hanging and firing squad to electrocution, to lethal gas, and now to lethal injection. And the quest, I think, has been to find a quote-unquote more humane method of executing someone. But the end result is the inmate's death, and that's exactly the same in any method that you're using. The Supreme Court's Eighth Amendment jurisprudence is also very curious and, from my perspective in that the law itself is very unprincipled, and I would say irreconcilable. And that is because, on the one hand, the court talks about how the touchstone of the Eighth Amendment is human dignity, but yet the law at this point, the Supreme Court allows executions to continue. Ironically, non-lethal corporal punishments have long been abandoned in the American judicial or penal system, got a case like Culp versus Peltzer from the U.S. Supreme Court, which described the handcuffing an inmate to a hitching post where the inmate got dehydrated and severely sunburned as an obvious Eighth Amendment violation. And Justice Blackmun, when he was on the Eighth Circuit back in the late 60s, actually described whipping as a violation of the Eighth Amendment as well. So in that sense, executions are a real anomaly in that non-lethal punishments are essentially have been abandoned, and we end up with what I would call kind of a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of approach to jurisprudence, giving the Eighth Amendment kind of a split personality. On the one hand, the Eighth Amendment is very protective. It protects inmates from harm. On the other hand, the Supreme Court continues to allow executions to go forward. The Glossop case, as Kent also mentioned, allows or requires an inmate to prove that there's an alternative method of execution. I think this is problematic, and here's why. I think it really turns the adversary system on its head. Lawyers for death row inmates are trying to save the lives of their clients, and I think it would be ethically problematic, at least it seems to me, for a lawyer to propose a method by which that person's client could be executed. This drug that's been, what was the question in Glossop, nidazolam, has been used in a handful of executions, but there's a lot of uncertainty, as Kent mentioned, about the science behind the drug and sort of how it works. And I think for a lawyer to basically argue in favor of another method of execution, perhaps one in which there's been no research being done, puts that lawyer in a really difficult spot. And I hope that the lawyers on the phone call would think of that issue as well. Third, I think there was some mention of how, in terms of the opinion, that there's been this sort of guerrilla war against the death penalty. And there's also mention of how the Europeans have banned the export of lethal injection drugs. But I think the lawyers at bottom are just representing their clients. Justice Scalia himself notes in his concurrence that condemned inmates are using the Eighth Amendment to bring challenges because it's the only way they can. I think that death row inmates should have that right to access the courts. I don't think individual lawyers for individual clients are somehow orchestrating what the European community is doing, for example, or really the social forces that work with the death penalty. The death penalty has become a very controversial subject, and the public opinion on the death penalty is really split. I think people should also have the right to express their views. One thing that I think is also continues to be problematic with Supreme Court's jurisprudence from Bayes into Glossop is the Supreme Court continues to focus on the pain, the risk of pain at the moment of an inmate's death. Of course, the Constitution does not prohibit painful and unusual punishments. It prohibits cruel and unusual punishments, and cruelty seems to me is a broader concept than just the sort of physical pain at the moment of execution. The Convention Against Torture, for example, refers to both psychological and physical pain or suffering as potentials. Justice Scalia, in his argument, says that the death penalty, basically he contends the death penalty is essentially perpetually constitutional because the Constitution uses the word capital in the Grand Jury Clause and uses the word life in the Due Process Clause. But that seems to me to be a too simplistic reading of the Constitution. The Grand Jury Clause and the two Due Process Clauses in the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments were put into the Constitution when the death penalty was still a mandatory punishment for certain crimes. And I think it would actually be shocking had the framers not included those protections. And those are, in fact, protections. The Double Jeopardy Clause refers to life or limb, but of course we no longer cut off people's limbs. We don't use non-lethal corporal punishments. And the Eighth Amendment really was written in broad, sweeping terms. It doesn't exempt the death penalty from its use. And more importantly, the addition of the 14th Amendment really changed, I think, the Eighth Amendment calculus. We added equal protection to the laws. And I think that the thing that's really undemocratic about the way in which death sentences are being administered is actually the death qualification process, that we're seeing death penalty opponents being stripped from being allowed to serve in capital cases, and that's resulting in a disproportionate number of African Americans, of women, of Catholics, of younger people not being allowed to serve in these cases. And that, to me, is something that I find very problematic about the continuing jurisprudence of the death penalty in this area. So I think I will also, as Ken had done, leave a little time, obviously, for questions, and be happy to talk more. I think that in the end, life without parole to me is the appropriate alternative. If we look back to the Enlightenment, we see that the founders actually embraced the principle of Montesquieu and Beccaria, which was that any punishment that goes beyond absolute necessity is tyrannical. And in that, the founders looked to that those kinds of ideas. And I think today, with the advent of life without parole sentences in the penitentiary system, we have a viable alternative to death penalty. And so that's what I would argue for.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Let's open it up to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, our lines are wide open at this point. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who might ring in today, let me apologize for our slow start here. We had some technical difficulties at the outset, so we had a bit of a slow start today. Let me talk about an upcoming Teleform conference call. That's going to be tomorrow. Our topic is Disinherited, How Washington is Betraying America's Young. It's the new book by Diana Furtschgoth-Roth. We'll be discussing it tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time with the author and with the chairman of our Administrative Law Practice Group Executive Committee, the Honorable Eileen O'Connor, who's a partner at Pillsbury Winthrop here in Washington, D.C. That is, again, tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Today, if you have a question on the death penalty, push the star button and then the pound button. And again, while we're waiting to see who might ring in, let me revert to Kent Scheidegger. Kent, see if you have anything to say to augment your statement or respond to Professor Bessler.
Yeah, let me just get back to one point that I think is really on the narrower version of the topic, and that is the use of method of execution challenges as an attempt to stop the execution altogether. The question as to whether the inmate should or should not be executed at all is something that has been considered on the direct appeal and then again on the state habeas corpus and then again on the federal habeas corpus. So that's already been over and over three times by the time we reach this stage of the process. And I think trying to use a civil suit to stop the execution altogether is a misuse of that process. The claim at that point is that the particular method of execution is unnecessarily painful and therefore cruel. But I know full well that that is what they're trying to do, is stop the execution altogether. And that's what the Supreme Court wanted to put a stop to. That if you're going to say this method of execution is unnecessarily cruel, then you have to give us an indication of what would allow the judgment to be carried out without what you claim to be an excessive risk of pain. So that's where we are with that, and I think that's the rationale of the decision.
So this is Dean Reuter again. One of the arguments I've heard is that proponents of delay, the folks, the anti-death penalty litigators who run out clocks, I don't know if run out clocks, but try to delay executions, should not then be able to turn around and argue that delay itself is sort of off topic, but that the delay itself amounts to a cruel and unusual punishment. The retort to that, of course, is that the particular defendant at issue in any given case is not necessarily responsible for the delay tactics of the overall opposition. I'm wondering if either of you have a response to that sort of critique.
Well, that's so-called the death row phenomenon, it's been called, and there's inmates who bring that particular claim, which there's not been our case reviewed at the Supreme Court level. It's called Lackey claims, after the name of the inmate who was the first one to bring that claim. Justice Breyer, in his dissent, which Justice Ginsburg joined, actually raised this point, one of several points that Justice Breyer made. He talked about, number one, sort of the arbitrariness of the death penalty itself. What we're seeing is as life without parole has become a more popular alternative, we're seeing the number of death sentences and the number of executions fall. But one of the things he talked about was the, quote, unconscionable long delays that undermine the death penalty's penological purpose. Going back a little bit, again, in history, Beccaria, who I mentioned, that actually the Continental Congress as body invoked the celebrated Marquis Beccaria in October of 1774, right before the Revolution, Revolutionary War. And one of his core principles was that there had to be an association between crime and punishment, and that you would want to have a speedy application of the punishment following the crime. And I think what Justice Breyer said in his opinion is that we now have a situation where we have death row inmates being executed about 18 years on average. And there's some other statistics talking about 15 years kind of being the average overall. That is something that's completely inconsistent with something the founders would have embraced, which is that if you're going to have a punishment mean anything, it has to follow fairly quickly after the crime to have that association. Otherwise, the any kind of deterrent effect would certainly be diminished. Again, I think that there's conflicting studies on the deterrence issues, and that's a topic for another day. But that core principle of sort of speedy imposition of punishments is certainly something we're not seeing with the death penalty. I think that obviously the courts are in charge of the judicial system and can move cases along. Obviously, people have a right to assert claims and exercise the due process rights, but there's a lot of social forces at work with the delays here, that sometimes judges just aren't issuing opinions in cases, that it's judges themselves that are often delaying decisions in these cases. And this is true even though you had the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, which I think was intended to speed up executions, but we're just seeing executions take longer and longer following crimes. I don't know if you want to add anything, Kent, on that point.
I think you're quite right that the act was intended to speed up the process. And there is one whole chapter that it added to Title 20 of the United States Code that was specifically for that purpose and that has not been implemented. The regulations to implement that chapter have been enjoined by a federal district court, which in my opinion had no jurisdiction to issue that order. And we're fighting that case right now. In fact, I'm working on a brief in that case today. So the tools are there to get around the fact that judges, as John says, sometimes just sit on these cases. We've got one case of an absolutely horrible murderer in California where the case has been fully briefed in district court, and it's just been sitting there for multiple years, and the judge doesn't rule on it. I mean, that's absolutely unconscionable behavior. And it is doable to get these cases done and executed in a reasonable time. My favorite example is the D.C. sniper, John Allen Muhammad. Virginia executed him less than 6 years from trial to execution. And that's the kind of time frame that is achievable, that has been done in Virginia, and that we should be seeing nationwide. And we could if we got the reforms properly implemented.
Was that at least in part due to the notoriety of the case, in your opinion?
No, it's actually not unusual in Virginia.
Okay. We do have a couple questions pending from the audience now. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call.
Hi, Larry Callahan. I was interested in this thing about those people who are concerned with delay. Put someone else back on. I need to rephrase my question, okay? I'll be right back.
Okay, you'll have to ring back in, Larry, but let's take the next caller.
Hi there. I had two interrelated questions based on the comments thus far. You mentioned a lackey claims for the delay and things of that sort. After Glossop, what types of Eighth Amendment challenges survive other than maybe a method of execution challenge like Bayes, like Glossop under the Eighth Amendment? And then secondly, would a method of execution challenge concerning compounded drugs, if the other drugs aren't available from the manufacturers, would a compounding challenge likely be successful if brought by plaintiffs?
I doubt that a challenge on the basis that the drug is prepared by a compounding pharmacy would be successful. you might get an order to test the drug to ensure its purity and potency, but once those are established, I don't think there's any Eighth Amendment challenge there. Just from the start.
If I can jump in, Kent, real quick. One of the things that you know, obviously Ken had outlined the case and took some of his time to do that, and having to show an alternative method. So, I mean, any method can still be challenged under the court's decision, but the DMA would have to show that alternative is there under, at least, you know, it's, again, it's a 5-4 decision. So if the court follows this opinion going forward, you can still challenge, but you have to sort of essentially propose an alternative method, and the person challenging the method has the burden to prove. The issue with the compounding pharmacies has been an interesting one, because what's happened is a lot of states have gone to passing secrecy laws so that they're not disclosing information surrounding sort of methods of execution in terms of, you know, sources of drugs and so on. And it does seem to me that as a lawyer, if you're challenging a method of execution, you really need to know what the method of execution is. You need to know all the details. So in other words, the legal brief that you prepare has to have a fact section in addition to a legal section that cites the law. And so one of the things that I think is going to be an ongoing battle is this need to get information. If you're trying, especially if you're trying to show that the method itself is cruel and unusual punishment, you need to know what the method is. If you're trying to show what the alternative is, you need to have access to information about what the alternative is to try to meet that standard the court has set out. As I've said, I think it's, again, problematic for people representing people that have been condemned to death row, because they have to now essentially propose or even stipulate essentially to a method that by which their client could be executed. And I do think that is problematic for the profession.
The first part of the question, if I can return to that, was what other Eighth Amendment challenges might be out there. In the early days, for the 70s and 80s, the Supreme Court was creating a lot of procedural rules under the guise of the Eighth Amendment. I think they're probably about done doing that. They haven't made any death is different procedure rules for quite some time. What they've been doing a lot more recently is carving out subsets of defendants who are categorically exempt from execution. And we've seen that with the intellectually disabled, persons under 18 at the time of the crime, minor accomplices swept up in the felony murder rule. They might not be finished with that, and they might carve out some specific subset of mental illness. So there's another possibility there.
Kent, the other one that I can think of, too, is that if you have some of these states have now gone to sort of adopting what I would call Plan B methods of execution. So Utah has passed a bill authorizing use of the firing squad. Oklahoma authorized the use of lethal nitrogen gas. You had another state go, Tennessee, for the use of the electric chair. So it's possible that if one of those methods was put into place or attempted to be used, that an inmate would bring a challenge to that. And there actually is an interesting discussion in the Bayes opinion where it said that lethal injection was the sort of national consensus for a method. And so that language is kind of language that you find in the discussion of the evolving standards of decency tests in the Eighth Amendment. So it may well be that if the court took up a challenge to one of those methods, that the court could still find that one of those methods was unconstitutional looking at the facts.
Yeah. I don't think they would, though, strike down an innovation simply because it was an innovation. So Oklahoma contends, based on a significant amount of evidence, that use of nitrogen to displace the oxygen in a mask or a chamber would actually be a painless method. And if that were true and that was actually implemented, I think that would probably be sustained even though it's new and even though it is replacing what has been a consensus.
The press, this is Dean again, the press made a fair amount of importance on the notion that two justices seem to indicate that the death penalty per se was unconstitutional. How much importance, if any, do either of you place on that? I mean, were you surprised that came out in
opinion? There have been one or two justices taking that position from the mid-70s to the present. So, you know, deja vu, we're back to 1972 with two justices taking that position. So unless they get more votes, I don't see that as a major development. The opinion is kind of interesting, and it takes every disputed contention about the death penalty, assumes one side to be true, and runs with it. It's quite a collection of talking points for one side, really.
Kent is referring to Justice Marshall and Justice Brennan. For many years, had these sort of relentless dissents where they would say the death penalty is unconstitutional per se. And Justice Breyer and Ginsburg have not gone quite that far. They said that basically they wanted to take up the issue of the death penalty as a whole, as the constitutionality. They haven't actually said, I think the words were, it's likely a violation of the Eighth Amendment. It's hard to believe, though, given, as Kent described it, the opinion that they would somehow reverse themselves and say that the death penalty is constitutional. So I think that Justice Ginsburg and Breyer have really staked out a position at this point, and the question is whether or not some of the other judges will eventually go along with them. One of the interesting things that I think is, it hasn't been talked about yet, and this is a small point that's raised in Justice Breyer's opinion, is this death qualification process, which I mentioned earlier. And one of the sort of the odd things about the Supreme Court's Eighth Amendment jurisprudence is that it gauges the evolving standards of decency by sort of doing a counting of the states, and it also looks at jury verdicts. But as I mentioned, that opponents of the death penalty are sort of systematically culled from these jury pools. And so when you get a death sentence, it is the result of jurors who've already basically said before the trial that they're willing to impose the death penalty. So you're eliminating a group of people essentially based on their political views about the death penalty going into the trial. And I think that that's a jury being a very democratic sort of institution, it's supposed to reflect the conscience of the community. The Supreme Court is really getting some skewed data when it analyzes jury verdicts because of the way in which the jury system plays out. And even though death penalty capital juries are death qualified, you're seeing in a number of states, including very traditionally very active death penalty states like Texas, that I think Texas for the first 6 months of the year didn't see any death sentences being imposed, even with the death qualification process, which seems to me that you're seeing a preference being expressed by jurors for that life without parole sentence, that's becoming a more popular option. And as that option continues to be more popular, I think, you know, executions, death sentences become even rarer. And at some point you have a situation where such a small handful of counties, even now we have a very small handful of counties resulting in the majority of executions, that the system becomes so arbitrary that the Supreme Court may have to step in and just say that this isn't consistent with equal protection of the law. And I think that 14th Amendment challenge is one that we may see down the road.
We do have a couple questions. I was just going to say, Kent, we have a couple questions pending, but go right ahead, Kent Scheidegger.
Yeah. The death qualification of juries, that is, excluding from the jury a person who says they will not vote for the death penalty under any circumstances, is a practical necessity so long as we insist on a unanimous verdict. You know, in the guilt trial, the jury has to be unanimous on what are essentially factual questions. As long as we continue to require in the penalty phase that the jury be unanimous on what is a subjective judgment, I think we have to insist that everybody involved in that be willing to entertain both of the options available. And it does work both ways. A person who would absolutely always impose the death penalty is also excluded, although there are fewer such people, to be sure.
Sure.
As far as the rareness of the death penalty goes, I think actually being more selective is a good thing. There are older cases that I see where you read the facts of the case and you go that even though that person is guilty, they shouldn't have been sentenced to death. But those are getting rare nowadays. The cases that I have worked on personally, when I read the facts of the case, I go, yeah, absolutely, this is a crime that calls for death. And that's how it should be. So I don't see that greater selectivity is necessarily a problem. It has always been the premise that the death penalty is not for all murders. Well, I say always within modern times, that the death penalty is not for all murders and should not be. It is for the very worst murders. And prosecutors and juries are indeed being more selective, and I think that's entirely proper.
Let's take another question.
This is David Burge in Atlanta. You know, given that a number of states are debating the death penalty, Nebraska, do you have a sense that the court was saying, like they did in some of the cases earlier this term, that they wanted to pull out of this issue a bit and let the political process and the states run with it for a while, or do you think they're still very interested in this topic?
I haven't seen any diminished interest. I mean, they've continued to take cases up. There was another case decided just a little bit earlier where they reversed the Ninth Circuit and reinstated a California death sentence. And then there was another case earlier than that where they took up a case on a mental retardation claim. So I don't see a pulling back at this point. And John, what do you think?
Well, I think it's a bit mixed. I mean, some of the cases that the court has taken where they've categorically excluded certain categories of offenders have not necessarily affected a huge number of people. So I would say that the court continues to kind of tinker around the edges without addressing that sort of core issue that, that Justice Breyer would like the court to take up again, which is the constitutionality of the death penalty as a whole. And it's hard to see how the court will take up that core issue anytime soon, given the current Glossop decision. But I think the court will continue to look at individual cases. There's been a number of cases where we've seen exonerations, and the court has been involved in some individual cases where they're looking at the actual evidence of the case to see if there was actually the innocent person was sentenced to death. And there's some interesting, if anybody's interested in looking at some videos, there's an interesting couple of filmmakers made some videos of death penalty exonerees. It's called One for Ten. And basically that the premise was that, you know, for every roughly 10 executions or so, we've seen about one exoneration. I think we're, Justice Breyer's opinion, as Kent mentioned, cites a number of things. One of the things is the number of exonerations and the number of instances where we're seeing evidence that, number one, either people have been actually wrongfully executed, and that's a smaller number than the people who have been wrongfully sentenced to death who were later exonerated. But it's that risk of executing the innocent, which has, I think, drawn a lot of people into this issue to question whether or not we should really be doing this when we can use life without parole. And we're seeing people, you know, sent to death row. This Glenn Ford case was a horrible example where somebody was sent to death row for many years and later exonerated. I think he just died of cancer shortly after being exonerated. So you're sometimes, again, seeing people exonerated after 20, 30 years. And if we speed up executions, those cases would presumably have slipped through the cracks, and we might have seen people, you know, executed who were actually innocent. So the due process has led to some findings of wrongful convictions, wrongful sentences. But again, given the current state of the Supreme Court, I don't think we're going to see the court itself take up that core issue of the unconstitutionality of the death penalty in the immediate term. Down the road, it's hard to say if the membership of the court changes what we might see.
Well, anytime someone brings up exonerations, it's important to mention that the so-called innocence list is not a list of people who have actually been proven innocent. The definition of exoneration that goes into that list is pretty loose, and there's a lot of guilty as sin murderers who actually did commit the murder and got away with it on that list. So don't believe the 1 in 10 number.
Well, and there's actually, on that point, Kent, there's actually two, Justice Breyer actually mentions two things in his dissent. One is the National Registry of Exonerations, which includes, as I understand it, both capital and non-capital exonerations. And the number there in capital cases since 2002 says has risen to 115. And the Death Penalty Information Center website is listed over 150. So there's different ways in which people are calculating those numbers. But I think the core point about actually people being exonerated is one that nobody really disputes, that there have been people wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death who were later exonerated.
Some, but nowhere near those numbers.
Sure.
We still have a couple questions pending. Let's go to our next caller now.
Hi, Larry Callahan. My apologies. After many years, I actually looked at an email that came up on my screen. This is pretty quick. With respect to the comment about the right to peremptory challenge someone that disagrees with a penalty, a death penalty, the possibility that a death penalty might be imposed. How is that any different than someone that might disagree with the fact that someone could even go to jail for a marijuana federal offense or X number of years for armed bank robbery? It just seems perfectly appropriate that a prosecutor should have the right to peremptory challenge someone that doesn't think someone should go to jail for any number of years in accord with the statute.
Yeah, but death qualification is not a peremptory challenge. It's a challenge for cause.
Yeah, and let me say a couple things on that point. Peremptory challenges have been used to often strike minorities from jury pools. So that's one thing that I think is problematic. If you allow too many of those, you allow for the some bias to creep in there. But let me pose just a question in response to your question. If you had a state, let's say it's a non-death penalty state, where somebody was being put on trial, and let's just posit that 60% of the people in that state were opposed to the use of the death penalty. If you essentially pulled out from the jury pool all of those 60%, you end up with 40% of basically the population. What happens is you end up with juries that don't really reflect necessarily the composition of the community, the fair cross-section of the community. So you end up with juries that don't look like the community. And I think that's problematic. And as you're seeing, you know, it, back in the Founding Fathers era, if you had sort of 95% of the whole population saying that there's a consensus that needs the death penalty, that's one thing. But if you start seeing the numbers be split, and increasingly as people have polled about the death penalty, if you don't just ask the abstract question about do you favor or oppose the death penalty, which there's still a majority of people that favor the death penalty in that question, but if you ask about the alternative being life without parole, a very severe, harsh alternative, people gravitate more towards that life without parole option. It seems to me is that as you get more opposition, the death qualification process itself becomes more problematic.
Well, that poll question is not a measure of opposition to the death penalty. That is a very, very badly worded poll question. It implies that the person must choose one penalty for all murderers. And if that were really the question, I would choose life without parole myself, as much of an advocate of the death penalty as I am. So that number really doesn't indicate. I think the true number is indicated when you ask jurors, which penalty do you favor for the worst murderers? And then you see it go back to a very large majority.
Once again, if you have a question, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a little over 10 minutes left, just one question pending, so let's take our next caller.
You've discussed a little bit the ethical problems that plaintiffs' attorneys in these types of cases may be presented with if they are obligated under Glossop to provide a alternative means of execution. Could you discuss that a little further and how that plays in terms of their pleading obligations and things of that sort?
Sure. I assume you're talking to me. One of the things that has been a subject of some controversy before the Supreme Court has been the ABA guidelines for the appointment and performance of defense counsel in death penalty cases. These were revised. There was a lot of people involved in drafting them, putting them forward. And the latest edition is the revised edition from February of 2003. And these guidelines have been cited quite frequently by lower courts. Justice Scalia is not a big fan of the guidelines, but the idea of the guidelines was try to set forth a national standard of practice for defense of capital cases in order to ensure high-quality legal representation for all persons facing the possible imposition or execution of a death sentence by any jurisdiction. And it seems to me that when you are representing somebody and you have an obligation ethically to be a zealous advocate for your client, one of the things that you're sort of ethically perhaps obligated to do would be to not offer up a way by which your own client could be executed. And that's kind of what the standard of the gloss of opinion basically requires a lawyer to do to prove up that a method of execution is unconstitutional, is often an alternative. It seems to me that if you have a state saying it wants to use a certain method of execution, that the only relevant inquiry is whether that particular method of execution is both cruel and unusual. If it's cruel and unusual, it seems to me it should be ruled unconstitutional. And what the Supreme Court has done essentially is put in sort of place a relative test requiring the petitioner to set forth some other method by which the person could be executed, essentially requiring that the inmate, as I see it, to basically stipulate that, look, if the state didn't use this method, it could use another method constitutionally to execute me, and then, you know, I guess the next case would sort of be over for the death row inmate and their lawyer, because they've already essentially stipulated that another method is proper.
The alternative method being a factor in the Eighth Amendment decision actually came from the challengers. There was a case back in 92 in the first execution in California in modern times, and then there was the Bayes opinion itself, where the argument being made by the people challenging the method of execution was that it presented an unnecessary pain or an unnecessary risk of pain because there was something better available. So that's where it came from. The Supreme Court didn't make that up on its own.
I will say, if you listen to the arguments, though, in these cases, I listened to Bayes recently, the oral argument, and in the Glossop decision. In the Glossop decision, for example, the attorney for the death row inmates was very careful sort of not to embrace another method of execution. The attorney kept saying, well, I'd have to look at that method to see if it was comported with the Eighth Amendment language. And so I think, at the very least, people representing death row inmates would be in an uncomfortable position.
Yeah, I'm talking about where it came from. It came from the defense side arguments in the earlier Bayes and Harris cases. So that's one point to be made on the issue. As far as, maybe we just leave it at that.
Once again, we're talking about the death penalty. If you joined us late, we're in the Q&A portion of the call. If you have a question, this is the last call for questions, I guess.
Push the start button. If there's no more question, let me go back and...
Let me just say this real quick, Kent. Push the star button and the pound button. I don't see any more questions, Kent. I just wanted to make sure we didn't have any more. But I do want to give each of you a chance to wrap up. Do you want to go first then, Kent? Or?
Well, let me say on the last point, I don't really think there's an ethical problem with proposing an alternative method. If it has been settled in multiple judgments that the client is going to be executed and the lawyer's concern is that one method is likely to be much more painful than another, I think it is consistent with the position of advocating for the interest of the client to advocate that the less painful method be used. And that's what the Supreme Court has required in Glossop.
Okay. Again, we don't have any questions pending. We've got a few minutes left. Let me revert to each of you for any final thoughts you might have. Let's start with you, Professor Bessler.
Okay, sure. Just a couple of quick points. I think going back again to the decision, and particularly, I want to talk just a second about Justice Scalia's concurrence. He focused in on this idea of the Enlightenment and how Justice Breyer really misunderstood the Enlightenment. And I think that's really not consistent with history. If you go back and again, in this book, The Birth of American Law, which I just finished working on, you find that the Founding Fathers were fascinated by this idea of an alternative to what was called the sanguinary system. And that was the penitentiary system. And the penitentiary system was really developed at the time of the Founding Fathers. It was not fully built out until after the founders were all dead and gone. But people like Jefferson drafted prison plans. People were really just fascinated by this idea of the possibility that we could find alternatives so we could eliminate the use of these severe kinds of corporal punishments. And we've seen over time the whipping post be abolished, the pillory be abolished, these non-lethal corporal punishments. And I think the anomaly of the death penalty is that, what it would be unconstitutional in terms of inflicting a non-lethal corporal punishment under case law, you suddenly go from the Eighth Amendment protecting you from various harms. The Eighth Amendment requires that prison officials provide clothing, shelter, adequate medical care. And then suddenly you shift over to the death penalty and somehow the Eighth Amendment transforms itself. And that to me seems an unprincipled way to read the Eighth Amendment. So I think in order to make the Eighth Amendment internally consistent, you really have to see the death penalty be declared unconstitutional.
Well, those other methods of punishment that were present in the founding and that are no longer used became unusual because the people decided through the democratic process to abandon them. And I think there is a very clear difference between that and the death penalty, at least at present in the United States, in that the death penalty is not unusual. It is endorsed by the vast majority of the people. It is the law in a very solid majority of the states. And so long as that is the case, I think it is not within the province of the judicial branch to declare it unconstitutional. I think that is something to be decided by the people through the democratic process.
Well, gentlemen, seeing no other questions, let me thank you both for your time today. We certainly appreciate it. These are obviously issues that will be revisited in the coming terms, and we look forward to having you both back on Teleforum in the near future. To our audience, a reminder to join our next Teleforum conference call scheduled for 1 p.m. tomorrow. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.